When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Greetings, fellow time travelers. Love you all. Great to have you with me for the journey without end through space and time. In this series, we look to the past to see what lessons there are to be learned, and there's plenty of them. And those lessons might help us deal with the here and now. Let us build towards a better future. And it's a grand endeavour, but we try in our own small ways. If you're interested in supporting the work that Paul and I do here with this podcast series, and if you want, on the upside, access to exclusive videos every week, then sign up to my Patreon.com site. Just go to Patreon.com, search for me by name, Neil Oliver, part with a bit of cash, and there you go. It's cheaper if you join for a whole year, but you can pay month by month. And either way, I'll love to see you there. You'll be welcome, part of the extended family. All right, it's now time to strap into the time machine as we set off once again towards the next stop in my love letter to the world. Recorder, microphone, action. Tens of millions of unquiet ghosts swirling around a network of brutal prisons and labour camps. One brilliant writer, drawing on reports, memoirs and letters, reveals a systematic horror inflicted upon an entire nation, lifting a corner of the Iron Curtain to let everyone see the reality behind. Endeavouring to understand history in hopes of illuminating the future, I'm Neil Oliver and this is my love letter to the world.
Morning, Neil. In the last episode, it was the 29th of October 1969, as a new era of human history was kickstarted with a simple message, hello. Where are we this week?
Hello, Paul, and fellow time travellers. Yes, it's hard to believe that only 55 years ago, the first message of the now all-pervasive internet was sent in California in the United States of America. Just incredible. But in this week's episode, we're travelling to Paris in 1973 as the brilliant Russian writer Alexander Solzhenitsyn publishes The Gulag Archipelago. Where are we? Well, I suppose we're in Russia, but it's a love letter to the world that considers sort of everyone and everything in a way. It's about the reality of the human experience. It's about the journey of the human soul. So it's fairly expansive. It's inspired by Alexander Solzhenitsyn and in particular his great magnum opus, The Gulag Archipelago, which published over a space of time. It came out in three volumes. It was published in Paris first time around in the 70s, 1,800 pages long, give or take the change. There are abridged versions of it. I'll be honest, I've only read the abridged version, which in itself is as big as The Lord of the Rings, and it's a major undertaking. But in every way, it's a major undertaking. It takes a lot of reading, and it's unsparing, and it's heavy, and it's not entirely a depressing work. You know, there are moments where the clouds break, and you glimpse the sunlight and the sunlit uplands and so on, but it's a hard one to read. The story of the world, as we often contemplate within the love letters, it often turns on the influence of a single person, a character like Jesus Christ, or the Buddha, or Muhammad or Gandhi. You know, there are these figures that seem to shift the earth on its axis all on their own by word or deed. Other times, quite often, there's a recurrent theme or pattern of two people who perhaps each on their own wouldn't have got the thing done for all sorts of reasons, but together they did. Kepler and Brahe, when it came to the understanding of the heliocentric sun at the centre of the solar system, Gutenberg and Fust, in terms of the printing press, one thought it up, the other provided the money that made it possible, and the Wright brothers, Orville and Wilbur, you know, they needed each other. But in this one, in the case of Alexander Solzhenitsyn, what you end up with the Gulag Archipelago is one book that changed the world. And it changed the perception. Well, it's if it didn't change the world, maybe it changed the way in which many people perceived the world. But it happened because of one author giving voice to ghosts, providing the testimony, the witness statements of hundreds of people that he himself had encountered. And by publishing their words in absentia, so to speak, he made a monument out of their testimony. The copy of the book I've got up there, I think it's published in 1986, and it's an abridgment, but it's lengthy. And before you even get into it, in the author's note at the beginning, he says, "Material for this book was given me in reports, memoirs and letters by 227 witnesses whose names were to have been listed here." So, you know, you go from thinking, well, obviously a book is typically the work of one person, one author, but he's acknowledging before you start reading it that he's speaking on behalf of others. And then he goes on in the next paragraph. He says, "What I express here to them is not personal gratitude, because this is our common collective monument to all those who were tortured and murdered in the Gulag Archipelago." He's recognising the sources of the testimony, so that when you start reading it, or even before you start reading it, you're aware, you're thinking of not just the 227 people that he specifically mentions, but all of the 60 million who died in the Gulag system. And even that outrageous number of 60 million is only an estimate, and it may be an underestimate of the consequences of the Gulag system, because there are all those who passed through the system and survived and returned to hidden, undocumented lives. So that on top of the 60 million, there were all manner of other people who went through it, who may have died unrecorded, unlamented even, but others besides who came through the system and then just somehow returned to lives, broken or otherwise. There's often a recognition of a moment in these love letters. I would say the moment is that original publication of the first volume on the 28th of December 1973. It wasn't an instant overnight success, but it has simply prevailed. Gulag, actually, a lot of people, I suppose, wonder what think Gulag is a word that means something, but it's actually a Russian acronym. It's G-U-L-A-G, and I'm not even going to attempt to break down what the acronym actually stands for, but it refers to the network, and it was a web of prisons and labour camps that were spread through the Soviet Union. And Solzhenitsyn describes the way in which they kind of settled over the place. He says, "And this archipelago crisscrossed and patterned that other country within which it was located, like a gigantic patchwork, cutting into its cities, hovering over its streets. Yet there were many who did not even guess at its presence, and many, many others who had heard something vague, and only those who had been there knew the whole truth." So that's the Gulag Archipelago. It's islands scattered through the Soviet Union, and each one was a prison or a place of detention or a labour camp or whatever. It all came together as what Alexander Solzhenitsyn imagined as the Gulag Archipelago. The man himself, he was born in Kislovodsk in 1918. He was a good student. He was a clever man, obviously, but he was a kind of a science leaning individual. He graduated from Rostov University in 1941 with a degree in maths and physics during the Second World War. He was a good soldier. He was enlisted in the army, in the Red Army. He had a distinguished record of service in World War II, so he was brave and an obedient soldier, obeying orders. But his undoing, if you like, or maybe the making of him, who knows, came after he made, well, let's say, disparaging remarks about the way Joseph Stalin was fighting the war. And he made those remarks in letters to a friend. And one way or another, the letters came into the hands of the watching authorities. And for having had the temerity, it would have happened to him anyway, but as a soldier, a servant of the state, he had negative things to say about how the great leader was prosecuting the war. And for that, he was condemned to the Gulag system for a period of time that stretched from 1945 until 1953. So he got pretty comprehensively swallowed up by the machine. And even when he came out in 1953, he was exiled initially to Kazakhstan. And that might have lasted for life. I mean, given the circumstances in which many people found themselves when they were exiled, you know, you came out of prison and instead of being allowed back to your old life, you were just put away into a distant place. And that could have been it for Solzhenitsyn. But after Stalin died, the new regime was led by Nikki Khrushchev. It's a great anecdote about Khrushchev, actually, that I remember reading somewhere. When he came to power, when he succeeded Stalin, he was in front of whatever, a large gathering of an audience somewhere. And someone shouted out from within it was a big, you know, like an auditorium, and a voice shouted out, you knew Stalin, you watched him doing what he was doing, why didn't you stop him? And Nikki Khrushchev leant into the microphone and just said, who said that? And there was silence. Nobody moved. Not a breath. You know, you could have heard a pin drop and so on and so on. And he let the moment stretch out, and then he leant into the microphone again and said, now you understand why. You know, why would you? Terror. Terror, plain and simple. You know, the certainty of destruction. So under the regime of Nikita Khrushchev, which was, you know, it was hardly free and easy, but it was easier perhaps than that of Stalin. And Solzhenitsyn was rehabilitated. And he began writing fiction. And in fact, he was very good at fiction, and he won the Nobel Prize for Literature in 1970. So very, you know, he was a skillful author. But it's his great work of non-fiction, the 1,800 pages of testimony about the Gulag Archipelago that changed him and changed everything. And it's Stalin's reign of terror broken down, exposed to the bright light of truth. And it should be read by everyone. And it should continue to be read by everyone forever. And it's forensic in its account. It doesn't shy away from the horror, from the sadistic cruelty. In so doing, it reveals that the communist regime, as all totalitarian regimes realise eventually, the communists in Russia and the Soviet Union realised that they could only approach, far less reach their ends, their desired ends, through force and terror. They couldn't take the people with them. They had to herd them in front of them with sharp sticks and the threat of absolute annihilation and destruction and personal pain and imprisonment and disappearance and all of the rest of it. So the book published in the 70s, and shortly thereafter, Solzhenitsyn was arrested in Russia and he was deported to West Germany, and he was stripped of his citizenship. So he was a non-Russian, a non-person. And subsequently he settled in the United States of America. He was there for a long time, but in 1994, after the wall came down, the Soviet Union broke up let's say by 1991, it was a very different place, and the wall had come down and his Russian citizenship was restored. So in 1994, he was able to return home, citizenship restored, and he lived out his life. He died of heart disease in 2008. And since its first publication and right up until now, the Gulag Archipelago has been published and republished over and over again in all sorts of different formats. It has sold millions of copies. I don't know how many, but it's a bestseller by any metric. But even in the abridged version, far less in the three-volume beast. But as I said before, it's not all darkness when you get into it. It's unsparing, but it's bright with truth. And it's ultimately about the journey of a human spirit, Alexander Solzhenitsyn's spirit, but perhaps arguably the human spirit, into darkness, through darkness, and out of darkness back into the light. And there's various points, as I say, at which the clouds break and you see sunshine. In volume three, there's a chapter called The Ascent, whereby Solzhenitsyn explains how he came to understand his own reality. And he goes into some detail about how the years of imprisonment had allowed him long periods of introspection, self-analysis. And he had realised that while his criticism of Stalin, the letters to the friend that got him chewed up by the Gulag system, that was not justification for his incarceration and everything that happened to him. But he realised by looking back at himself that his own actions while he was a soldier and while he was a communist and before he fell out with the system or got on the wrong side of the machinery, that he himself had been less than blameless, to put it mildly. You know, that he had done things for which he was not punished, but that he could see now in his heart had been wrong. So he got off with all of that and then got incarcerated for really something quite irrelevant. But he could see that he deserved to be punished. He said, "Slavery nurtures in you the shoots of contradictory feelings. Once upon a time, you were sharply intolerant. Formerly, you never forgave anyone. You judged people without mercy, and you praised people with equal lack of moderation. You have come to realise your own weakness, and you can therefore understand the weakness of others." So he's, you know, he can see that when he was on top, when everything was going his way and he was condemning and praising, you know, when he was condemning, he was sending people into the same darkness that ultimately swallowed him. And it was the Gulag that taught him that. Solzhenitsyn exemplifies something very important that happened much more broadly in the Soviet Union, in that communist regime of Stalin and others. All the way back in December 1934, the head of the Communist Party in Leningrad, who was called Sergei Kirov, was assassinated. He was coming out of his office in Leningrad and into the corridor, and he was shot and killed. And in that kind of, you know, Lee Harvey Oswald way, there was a misbegotten individual who carried the can for that. He was an unemployed man who had, well, as far as the story went, he'd been expelled from the party. And the idea was that he had borne a personal grudge against Kirov that had eventually caused him to, or inspired him to go and kill the man. But more seasoned observers, people, you know, with a bit more going on in their heads, understood that it was Stalin that had Kirov assassinated, because he was eliminating a rival or a potential rival. But that said, the official Stalinized investigation into Kirov's death drew the conclusion that it had been this unemployed maverick. But the whole thing grew then from the assassination of Kirov. During the next 4 years, let's say, that whole what's going on here investigation, in inverted commas, metastasized into Stalin's witch hunt, a purge, and eventually show trials, which were broadcast to the world. You know, they went international, apparently exposing all these high-level threats to Stalin from within the party itself, you know, that he'd had no alternative but to root out the bad apples in the barrel and so on and so on. But in the process of purging the party, he ended up trying and then executing the oldest and most trusted Bolsheviks alive. People who had been with Lenin in the beginning. It went all the way to the top, effectively. And the narrative was that there were all these traitors within the party who were acting as the puppets of Trotsky, who had already been exiled. And the plot was to kill Stalin and, you know, to hand territory to Nazi Germany and restore capitalism to Russia. There was even talk that they'd been putting ground glass in the butter that was going out to the hardworking Russian people. And the high point of the whole show trial experience saw two of the most senior veterans imaginable, Lev Kamenev and Grigory Sinoviev. The judge reading out the verdict denounced them as mad dog capitalists who deserved only to be shot, and they were. This has gone down in history as Stalin's Great Purge. It lasted from 1936 to 1938, but as well as the show trials, it's what sent millions to the gulag. Millions and millions of unfamous, largely anonymous figures just disappeared into the gulag system. And, you know, you have to pay attention to the fact that by the 30s, into that time when you eventually get to, let's say, the civil war in Vienna and the Spanish Civil War, communists and especially communist intellectuals, they had learned, they taught themselves to be okay with killing for the greater good. You know, that people had to die to get to the communist utopia. They told themselves this, as well as telling everybody else this. And that included, you know, the famine deaths in the Ukraine, the Holodomor, the Great Hunger. That was described in the Times. The Times in London, the correspondent in Moscow, in reporting the famine, the controlled famine that killed 3 million people, he said, well, you can't make an omelette without breaking some eggs. That was the attitude that was already there through the 30s. But it was one thing. I mean, you know, in when it came to, say, what happened with the starvation in Ukraine, they were going after what they called the kulaks at that point. The kulak is a name that means, it's a nickname, it's a pejorative. It means a clenched fist, and it refers to somebody who's tight with money, mean and grasping. The mob was turned on the kulaks, and, you know, the millions died all over. But what then do you make of all the killing of these old Bolsheviks who had been with Lenin, who had led the revolution, who had been there from, who you would imagine were the old guard? And Zinoviev, one of those two in two of the most famous show trials, he'd been a member of the first Politburo. He'd been head of the Comintern. The Comintern was that thing that, you know, to take communism international, you know, to spread communism around the world, get it out of the Soviet Union, get it everywhere, the Comintern. And yet, when he had been sentenced to die, and he was given the opportunity to speak, to give his last words, and some of them he admitted, in inverted commas, that his communism had gone bad. His Bolshevism had gone bad, and he had fallen to Trotskyism and ultimately to capitalism. He just gave this complete confession of a fall from grace. And to his children, he said, no matter what my sentence will be, I in advance consider it just. Don't look back. Go forward together with the Soviet people. Follow Stalin. I mean, you know, could you imagine anything that sounds more scripted? And you have to ask, were people like Zinoviev, were they broken, just like any human being, by torture? Or did they fear for their captive families? Because for sure, you know, their wives and children and whatever were within the Soviet Union and were at the mercy of the system. Or in the way that Solzhenitsyn was able to describe about himself, had men like Zinoviev, even like prophets of the gospel of communism, had they come to realize that while they were innocent of the crimes that brought their death sentences, you know, that they hadn't conspired to kill Stalin at all, but they had nonetheless done terrible things from at least 1917 onwards. If they hadn't actively taken part in the mass killing and the purges, they had stood idly by, or they had turned blind eyes and deaf ears to it. And so that realization that, yeah, I'm being undone now by trumped up charges, but I do have crimes to answer for. In essence, that's what Solzhenitsyn also experienced, and what he wrote about, and that was his understanding of his own journey. Ultimately, they had to atone, if not for the crimes for which they were convicted, then for all of the crimes for which they had been unpunished. So in March 1946, at Westminster College in Fulton, Missouri, in front of an audience that included President Harry S. Truman, the then former Prime Minister of Britain, Winston Churchill, made his famous remarks bemoaning Soviet Union policies in Europe. So he said, "From Stettin in the Baltic to Trieste in the Adriatic, an iron curtain has descended across the continent." It's from that speech in 1946 that we get this notion of the Iron Curtain. And its removal took a long time. You know, it was drawn across Europe in 1946, and its eventual removal was the effort of thousands of people, tens of thousands of people, most of them unknown, chipping away. But, you know, luminaries amongst who are at least credited with bringing down the Iron Curtain, Mikhail Gorbachev, Ronald Reagan, Margaret Thatcher, Pope John Paul II, and on and on and on. But although it came down or was torn aside in 1989, by then we had long since been invited to look behind the Iron Curtain, to glimpse the reality of Soviet Russia, of the Soviet Union. And that had been the work of one man. But that one man had spoken for hundreds, of whom he had had personal experience. And then, by extrapolation, he was speaking for the tens of millions who were consumed by the teeth and cogs of the machine that was the Gulag Archipelago. And most famously, within the 1,800 pages, he said it was the Gulag that had taught him what he had needed to know about what it is to be human and alive. And indeed, it's what everyone needs to know. "It was granted to me to carry away from my prison years on my bent back, which nearly broke beneath its load, this essential experience, how a human being becomes evil and how good. In the intoxication of youthful success, I had felt myself to be infallible, and I was therefore cruel. It was only when I lay there on rotting prison straw that I sensed within myself the first stirrings of good. Gradually it was disclosed to me that the line separating good and evil passes not through states, not between classes, not between political parties either, but right through every human heart and through all human hearts." And that's where we should leave it. A little girl dressed in red, small, bright, and irreplaceably precious. On the 21st of December 1988, she climbs aboard Pan Am Flight 103 on her way from London to New York. 31,000 feet above the Scottish town of Lockerbie, a terrorist bomb hidden aboard the plane is detonated. The girl and all 259 passengers and 11 people on the ground in Lockerbie are killed. An atrocity that changed the world, opening another door leading from the world of before to the world of after. Next time in my love letter to the world. To help support this podcast and to get access to new content every week, sign up to the Neil Oliver site on patreon.com. I'd love to see you there. I've got a new website address, nice and simple for these complicated days. It's just neiloliver.com. Check out my shop for series merchandise, for t-shirts and mugs and hoodies and all of that. My Instagram account is called Neil Oliver Love Letter. My YouTube channel is simply called The Neil Oliver Channel. You can see the theme, and it features new films every week. To help build this podcast, tell your friends about it, get them listening, and write a review to convince the online crowd to join us. For further reading about these moments in time, you could try my book, The Story of the World in 100 Moments, published by Transworld. Neil Oliver's Love Letter to the World is produced by Paul Ratcliffe and Neil Oliver for Catnip Inc. The music is composed by Milo McKinnon. The social media and YouTube producer is Oscar CFR. Additional research is by Evie, Lucy and Arch and Teddy. Finances by Catherine and Trudy. Post-production is by Squared Studios and the graphics are by Paul Plowman. Thanks for listening. This has been a Catnip Inc. Podcasts production.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Want to join a film club that has real frank discussions, talking about films that you actually want to watch?
Well, then look no further, because we are Frank Film Club with me, Maisie Williams. And each week we watch a film and then come together and obsess over it, or sometimes absolutely slate it. Either way, there's always a lot to say. And the films that we pick range all the way from like 90s and noughties classics all the way up to new releases that are coming out every single week. And sometimes we get our listeners to pick for us.
And we all work in the film industry, don't we, ladies?
Indeed.
So we really love to look at specifically how a film was made.
So if this sounds like your bag, then come and have a listen to Frank Film Club. And remember, absolutely everyone is welcome in this club.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.